Georgia's DBHDD is warning all Georgians that half of all opioid deaths happen at home, when people take an Oxy or a Perc with a glass of alcohol for stress or to sleep. Learn more about protecting families from opioid overdoses at opioidresponse.info.
Thanks for listening to the Political Rewind podcast. Be sure to like and follow us and rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. I'm starting a brand new week and very happy to have all of you with us for the show today. Let me get right to introducing the panel. Patricia Murphy, a political reporter and columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Patricia's column is in the Wednesday and Sunday newspaper, and of course she oversees The Jolt, which appears at AJC.com. Great roundup of the day's political news for you to read. How are you, Patricia?
I'm doing great. How are you, Bill?
I'm fine. I'm fine. I got up this morning. I went on our back porch. It's cool. It's brisk. It's just, I love this weather, Patricia.
And it must be election season. I feel like once there's like that, that crisp in the air, it's time for a debate. That's how my brain works.
Yeah. Kurt Young is with us. Kurt Young, professor of political science at Clark Atlanta University. Kurt, how are you?
I'm doing great, Bill. Like you, I enjoy this time of year, especially here in Georgia. And looking forward to an exciting week and glad to start it off with you and your guests this morning.
Yeah, we're very happy to have you here. And we're also happy to have Senator Sonia Halpern, Democrat from Atlanta, back on the show. It's been a while, but it's really good to have you back on, Sonia.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. It has. It's been a while, so I always love in being able to be in conversation with you. And fall is my favorite time of year, so I am looking forward to the continuing cooler temperatures.
Yeah, I got you. Edward Lindsay is back with us. Of course, Edward's a former Republican member of the House, leadership member of the House in his day. Now, he runs the Georgia practice, the Georgia government relations practice at Edward Denton's, the world's largest law firm. How are you?
I'm doing great. And Patricia, I'm reading The Jolt right now to make sure that I'm up to date before we start.
Good. We won't
there's some
call
good
on
items.
You until you read it.
Yeah, that's right. Patricia, I think I'd like to start today looking again, as we have on other days, but there are developments on abortion and the kind of role it is likely to play in the midterm elections this year. One of the reasons it's particularly interesting, I think, today is we see this steady march of conservative states moving toward outlawing or restricting in very severe ways abortion. And the most recent state, Arizona, where a judge ruled that a law passed in 1864, which was before Arizona was even a state, that bars abortion except to save the life of a pregnant woman, in fact, has been reinstated. It was a block back in 1973 when it was found to be unconstitutional by an Arizona court. And then, of course, Roe v. Wade kept it from being activated. But, Patricia, there are pro-choice people who think 1864, a law passed before this was even a state, just another reason that pro-choice forces feel that abortion is going to motivate a lot of people to turn out for the polls. Yes?
Yes. Democrats in Georgia really believe that this is the animating issue for their voters when it comes to who they're going to support in the fall. They believe that because it is just at such a historic inflection point for the issue, that it will play a much larger role than it has in the past, even among voters who are typically pro-choice. Now, Republicans just don't agree with that. I talk to Republican campaigns all the time and say, I just don't quite understand why abortion is not showing up. If it is supposed to be this big issue that people are going to be voting on, and it's logical that especially women who are pro-choice would vote on this issue because of the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. But Republicans say, listen, the economy, jobs, inflation in particular, that is what they see motivating the majority of Georgia voters. They also say that Governor Kemp, that his approval rating, this is already baked into his approval rating, in their opinion, because that law passed in 2019 and the governor signed it in 2019. The difference in the legal status of Roe v. Wade, they say, doesn't change the way voters are factoring this issue into the election because they've already made the calculation that they that he signed that law and they like him anyway. Or for pro-life people, they sign he signed that law and that's why they like him even more. Now, Democratic candidates I talked to, somebody like Senator Halperin, say this just does not comport with what they're seeing and hearing on the ground. But I think we just don't know what role it's going to play. That's the reality.
Patricia, before I bring everybody else in, let's talk briefly about the column that you wrote or that appeared in the paper over the weekend. You were up in Cleveland, Georgia, where you met with his June. Is it Kreiss? Is that how she pronounces her last name?
Yes.
Great. Democratic candidate for the state house in a red district. She is running. She said she told you that she thought health care was going to be the top issue in her campaign. But you report that in the aftermath of the Roe decision by the Supreme Court, that that has become the dominant issue in her race. And she also told you that she really, because it's a red district, doesn't expect to win against Stan Gunter, the incumbent. But she feels that by taking on this issue, it might move the needle a little bit more towards Stacey Abrams. Have I got that right?
Yes, and that's what Stacey Abrams really needs to happen, is to close the margins with Republicans, even in these very, very red counties. Donald Trump won White County with 83% of the vote. I mean, the Democrats are just not going to win there. But June Kreiss and Democrats up there say, could they narrow that with the abortion issue, even among some Republican women voters, could they narrow that to 81%, 79%, they believe that's not only they think that's possible. They also think it's really Stacey Abrams' only hope right now, that there are unlikely voters out there, not just the likely voters being polled, but the unlikely voters who will come out and vote on this abortion issue. Stacey Abrams needs to close those margins along with bringing out her own Democratic base in November, and but the polls are really showing it's going to be a real heavy lift.
Sonia Halperin, let me get you in next on this. This in the polling that the AJC did, abortion did not rank very high on the list of priorities that voters told the pollsters they were going to vote on. But what that Cleveland, Georgia story tells us is that you may not need a large number of people who are motivated by abortion as an issue, just enough to, again, move the needle toward the Democratic candidates. Yes?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, at the end of the day, Georgia is, you know, as much of a 50-50 state, right, or at least trending that way. We'll see what happens when we get out of the 22 election cycle. But for sure, this election will likely be won in the margins. So these aren't going to be, you know, wide numbers that separate candidates. And so if that's the case, then it really is about trying to find voters where you can find them, including in counties or parts of the state that don't historically think of as Democratic strongholds. Because at the end of the day, it really is about connecting with voters throughout the state. If you're going to be a statewide candidate or even district level, it's connecting to constituents. And so going to other places around the state, talking to women, making sure that people understand what is on the ballot, and abortion's on the ballot as much as healthcare generally is. Because for folks like me who are Democrats, we say abortion is healthcare. So it also creates the pathway for other kinds of conversations that are important for Georgians to at least consider.
Edward?
Yeah, if I may, sort of three quick points. One is that it is going to be interesting, as Patricia and you pointed out earlier,
as to whether or not the abortion issue actually moves the needle in terms of folks who might otherwise vote Republican would vote Democrat. You know, this is this. There's a long history in the United States going back to the Prohibition movement, for instance, as was outlined in a book called Last Call, of trying to get single issue organizations trying to get folks to vote on just that issue, regardless of anything else. And the question is, how many voters will move from the R category to the D category? I suspect not too many. As shown by the polls that that you and Patricia pointed out, the governor, you know, signed this bill 3 years ago, and he's still up by significant percentages. In fact, over 50% in some polls. The third point I want to raise, and I think perhaps to move sort of expand beyond just the abortion issue, I think it's good for democracy anytime that I see political parties reaching into areas where they might not otherwise be fertile ground and trying to attract voters into their category. I think it's always bad when any political party starts taking one group or another for granted. I think it's good that the Democrats are reaching into our areas on this issue. I think it's good that Republicans are reaching into African-American, Hispanic, communities when it comes to education issues, for instance, or economic issues. I think it's dangerous any time that in a democracy when one party or the other simply assumes that a voter will always vote with them. So I think it's a good trend, and quite frankly, it bucks a more dangerous trend that we've been seeing by some people in both parties that seek not only to demonize their opponent, but to start to demonize the supporters of their opponent. And so anything that shows people of parties reaching into the other side, traditional base, I think is a good thing.
Kurt?
Yeah, Bill, I agree with the sentiment of the panel. I don't see, of course, we've been discussing how evenly split it seems the state is these days in terms of these statewide elections. And I agree, I don't see a lot of shifting of votes from one party to the next. Of course, in that kind of situation, it is the party that will not only achieve the highest level of turnout, but as we're seeing now, perhaps introduce new voters to the process, right? And so we are recognizing that. I think U.S. News and World Report identified 6 out of 10 voters who are requesting ballots for early ballots are women, all right? And then we're seeing that they're newly registered women on the Democratic side, right? Also, the Democratic Party would argue that the excitement in terms of registering new women voters are on their side. Now, a few years ago, we saw after, I want to say 2017, after Trump's first election, we had a major protest throughout the country of women being mobilized, right? And there's an argument that connected that major protest to what occurred in 2020. Now, I'm not quite sure that that's the case, but I think that there's evidence to suggest that if those who want to make that argument can point to a direct line between that excitement that occurred in 2017 all the way to 2020. The question is, can we see this abortion issue in that same kind of vein and having the impact on what would normally be history is on the side of the party that's out of the White House to gain seats in the midterms? There's talk of a pink wave now, right, that associates itself with this abortion issue. So I think, as Patricia said, we have to see. But I think that there are signals here that we have to decipher in terms of those who are new voters and voting in different ways in this new election.
Patricia, I do want to point out, of course, what Kurt's talking about is the Women's March, which drew an enormous crowd of women to Washington to protest against Donald Trump's election and to talk about their issues. Go ahead and weigh in, but I do want to point out that I think what's interesting is in the lead of your column sort of points to what we've talked about, what Kurt's just talked about. You said that Cleveland, Georgia, White County went 83% for Donald Trump in 2020. And you said it's the last place, Cleveland, where you'd expect to see a Democratic meeting draw a room full of potential voters at noon on a Tuesday. And yet it was crowded. I think Melita Easters, Georgia Wynn List was up there as well, right? So talk a little bit about what that says to you about an energy that might be developing.
Yeah, well, I also, along with the size of the group that was there in this, you know, very small town, I was really interested in the way that they are framing the abortion issue up there. It is not being soft-pedaled. I mean, this was a very frank conversation about abortion, rape, incest. Should men be penalized also for their role in unwanted pregnancies? There were signs on the wall that said, I'm not overreacting, see you in November. You know, these were people who were really pushing this issue hard. They were not kind of tailoring it to make it more neutral or less of a hot button issue, even though it's a very Republican county. And June Chris, who's the candidate there, spoke just in an extremely emotional way. She's a nurse and said that there are cases that come through the ER for doctors and nurses that are just so unspeakable. They're not spoken of, but these are people's real experiences in terms of knowing somebody who was raped or knowing somebody who had an abortion or somebody who had an abortion themselves for women that they don't talk about. And so they say they believe this really is somewhat of a sleeper issue in a way, even though it's getting lots of headlines. It's not the type of thing that's really discussed openly among voters and even between couples. And so they really think that women are going to get into the voting booth and make a decision that people don't necessarily expect.
Sonia, let me add an element to this conversation. In the past week, Stacey Abrams in a group of women made the observation that what Republicans call a fetal heartbeat, which is what that six-week law is based on, the detection of a fetal heartbeat, is not, in fact, a heartbeat. It is a sound generated, I think I've got this right, by the ultrasound equipment. It is not really the heartbeat. Now, I get that there are Democrats who, and I think doctors suggest that absolutely is correct. And I get that that's a good rallying cry for Democrats, but it's also something Republicans, there's already some tweets going out about it, suggesting that Stacey Abrams is insensitive, doesn't understand that these really are living babies. What about that statement?
I think because we are in such a hyper-partisan environment, whatever anybody says gets taken and run away with on the other side, both sides, right? Ultimately, what we could be having is a conversation around viability, but that's not the conversation that we're having. Instead, we're kind of arguing about, you know, heartbeat versus not heartbeat. And I think that because we're also in this moment where science isn't necessarily defining the actual conversation that's being had, it doesn't end up doing any good. Stacey Abrams could be technically correct, but it won't matter. And so what is the conversation that we really should be having around this issue that people left, right, or undecided can actually understand and help inform them around how they actually want to feel about this issue. And again, there may be very few people at this point who haven't already made their own clear-cut decision on where they land on this issue, but it ends up being a little bit of noise and doesn't actually get to really what is the root of that conversation. It's not really about the heartbeat. It really is a conversation about viability. And if we can talk about it that way, it might actually inform people differently.
Let me, while the ball's in your court, let me ask you this question, Sonia. Let's bring it to down ballot races. To what extent is abortion playing a role in legislative races, to the best of your understanding right now?
Right. I mean, certainly, I think that one of the things that is happening in the state legislature, particularly for Democrats who believe abortion is an animating issue, is a conversation around the makeup of our state legislatures, because the Dobbs decision effectively said we're taking it back to the state level. It's a great opportunity to really talk about the influence that our state legislatures have on laws. Governor Kemp signed a law back in 2019 because it was passed through the General Assembly. And so the makeup of your General Assembly is going to determine a lot the kinds of bills that actually do make it all the way through to the governor's desk.
Kurt, and you know, then Edward.
You know, Bill, when I'm listening to these various campaign ads, well, I'm hearing two things. On the one hand, I'm hearing, and I think Sonia's exactly right, I'm hearing that the Republican Party of the state of Georgia, at least in the context of its campaigns, have made a decision that regardless of anything that Stacey Abrams says, it will figure out a way to politicize it. Now, I don't know that that's any different from what we've seen in the past, but it seems that there is really no serious conversation or weight given to the accuracy or the substance of the comment. Whatever the statement is or whatever statements exist, they'll be taken in such a way that can help mobilize the electorate. What's interesting is that I'm not sure that it really needs to, the electorate needs to be mobilized in that way. On the other side, what I'm hearing from the Democratic Party and this campaign operations in general, and certainly in the Abrams camp, is to attach this abortion issue to the extreme right claim. You see it, or you hear it, in the first few words of that ad that Abrams launched, that cast the governor as being far right. Right now, where that can be a factor is in the extent to which national politics corroborate the claims that are being made at the state level, particularly in the state of Georgia. We saw over the weekend this recent, I guess it was a mistake by Speaker McCarthy to release this commitment on America, commitment with America. I can't remember the exact language. Taking us back to the contract with America days a few decades ago. And then also recent Senator Lindsey Graham's claim or contribution to a national discussion of establishing a federal ban on abortion. And so these dynamics, I think, contribute in a way that will expand this abortion discussion in ways that we perhaps haven't seen in the past.
Edward?
You know, abortion is one of these issues that that does tend to polarize. I remember when I first ran for office, a friend of mine who was getting me prepared to run asked for my opinion on abortion, and I went on for about 2 to 3 minutes, and he said, "Now you just stop there, okay? State your opinion in about 15 seconds, and then move on, because you're not going to change anybody's opinion. All you're going to do is irritate somebody when you start going on for a few minutes." Which is great political advice. It's lousy policy advice. It gets back to what Sonia was talking about a moment ago, in which we do need to have a serious discussion between people, because most Americans actually understand a woman's right to privacy, a woman's right to choose at some point during the pregnancy, but also at some point believe that the innocent life needs to be protected too. And that lies somewhere between the two polar opposites along the spectrum, and that's where most Americans are based on the polls that I've seen. But the parties during a political race can't do anything. I need to add one other thing. What's dangerous about Stacey's comment wasn't her question as to the science. What was dangerous about it was what she added on to it, in which she basically demonized not just the issue, the position, but also the people who were supporting it. By basically saying that it's simply an attempt by men to subjugate women and their bodies. That's dangerous when you start basically stigmatizing an entire sincere group of people who are pro-life, which includes, quite frankly, tens of thousands of women in this state. So, you know, you got to be dangerous. You got to be careful about that sort of thing. And I would caution both parties from ever doing such a thing.
Right. I really appreciate this conversation, and I want to get to a break and move on. But Patricia, real quick before we do, what Edward just said about, you know, the political way of dealing with this is do it in 15 words, good politics, bad policy. Interestingly enough, I thought in your column, Stan Gunter's comments about abortion are an example of thinking, being thoughtful about this subject, not just giving the standard Republican pro-life line. He kind of acknowledged to you that he wrestles with this issue.
He did, but he also said nobody has ever asked him how he would have voted for that bill. He is a first-term lawmaker elected in 2020, so after the heartbeat bill was passed. And I said, well, how would you have voted on that? He said, you know, nobody's ever asked me that. I'm like, wow, that comes as a huge surprise to me. But he said, you know, I do have some real concerns about that bill. I thought he meant that I thought he meant that that the bill had gone too far. And he said, when it comes to rape and incest, I struggle with that. I really believe that that is a life, and I'm not sure that I'm comfortable with those exceptions in the bill.
Ah, oh, mm-hmm. Okay. So he was talking, okay, thank you for clarifying that. I thought he was talking about the issue in a larger sense. Thank you for that. All right, let's do this. Let's get to our first break in the show. We'll be back with more after these messages.
Thanks for listening to Political Rewind. If you like this show, you'll also like Georgia Today. It's a daily podcast from GPB News, bringing you compelling stories and in-depth reporting that you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Peter Biello, for this quick and convenient way to get the best of GPB News' extensive coverage of the topics that matter to you, delivered directly to your device every weekday afternoon.
Edward Lindsay, State Senator Sonia Halpern, Kurt Young from Clark Atlanta University, and Patricia Murphy join me for today's Political Rewind. Patricia, looking at the AJC poll last week, we saw a Senate race, which is a razor-thin margin, but in which the Libertarian, Chase Oliver, may be drawing just enough votes that neither Walker or Warnock are able to get over 50% on November 8th. Which means what, Patricia?
That means a runoff.
Another runoff.
We call it the R-word in the AJC newsroom because last year's 9-week Senate runoff campaign just about killed everybody who ever worked for the AJC. So we like not to think about these things, but that Warnock-Walker race is, as you said, neck and neck. However, with a meaningful number of potentially Republicans, we're not exactly sure who, but supporting Chase Oliver. Oliver ran for the 5th District seat after John Lewis died. So he's a known quantity. He's also very well known among Libertarians because he's headed the Atlanta chapter of Libertarians for some time. And so he's got a good bit of name ID among Libertarians. If he draws that support away, and we do know that there are Republicans, a few Republicans still uncomfortable with Herschel Walker. At the same time, Raphael Warnock has never gotten close to clearing 50% in these polls, obviously he was able to win that Senate seat over an incumbent the last time around. So he's well positioned, but not clearing 50% the way that he would like to be right now to be comfortable that he's going to be able to avoid a runoff in this race.
Yeah, Edward, if you're an incumbent, you really would like to see your number up at 50% or higher at this stage of the race.
Yeah, it's a scary situation for an incumbent if you're thrown into a runoff. That's what happened back in 1992 here in Georgia when there was a runoff and Paul Coverdell, the challenger, was able to win. That's what happened just 2 years ago when Senator Perdue was thrown into a runoff and got beat in a runoff. So no incumbent wants to be thrown into a runoff. But let me also give you the good news about a runoff. It will not interfere with your watching Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer because the runoff season has now been shortened to to, I believe, the first Tuesday after Thanksgiving.
Yeah, 4 weeks.
Which means that it will interfere with your watching the parades on Thanksgiving Day, but won't reach into the Christmas season. And, you know, we'll just have to see. But you can't help but feel that there is within at least a small percentage of more Republican-leaning voters still some uncertainty about Walker, because Libertarian doesn't seem to have any real significant impact in the governor's race. I think he's down around, Patricia, I think, according to your poll, somewhere hovering around 1%. The Libertarian in the Senate race has 3 or 4 percentage points, which would almost definitely throw it into a runoff. But, you know, I will also say this. Walker's had everything thrown at him that you could possibly imagine. And yet he's still either tied slightly up or slightly down, depending on which poll you want to see. So it's going to be an interesting season over the next 4 weeks.
You know, Sonia, I think that's a really important point that Edward makes, that the Warnock campaign, PAC supporting Warnock, have poured millions and millions of dollars into ads attacking Walker, a lot of it on his history of violence toward women, his ex-wife, with that very dramatic series of ads in which he talks about him holding a gun to her head. And yet, if anything, Walker has improved in his standing in the polls in the past weeks, especially since he changed out his campaign team and now has a much more disciplined and professional group running the campaign.
Yeah, I this race for me more than any of the others it's a fascinating study because you've got two candidates. Both happen to be African-American men. One's clearly an incumbent and has a long history of public service. The other does not. And yet the polls are showing them neck and neck. I think what it says to me and to many of us, right, is that really people are not necessarily looking at the individuals. They're not necessarily rallying around policy, but they are looking at party as one of the most defining factors in their vote and who will get their vote. I don't know. Somebody else would have to explain to me why a Herschel Walker is neck and neck with a Raphael Warnock. And again, I'm not even saying that you have to like all of Raphael Warnock's policies, but in terms of the kind of person that you might want to represent you, it's a striking difference. And yet the polls show them tied with the possibility of a runoff.
Yeah, I think, Kurt, I want you to jump in here, but Sonia talks basically about tribalism. Of course, he's a superstar football a legend, which has some impact, but tribalism is playing apparently a role in many races across the country.
So let's think about it. We've said time and time again that all politics are local, but at the same time, local politics exists within the context of national politics. And this election is not going to be any different. Part of the reason that you have this, quote, tribalism that's occurring is because it's part of the national political dialogue. We have a president just recently who said that if he murdered someone on Fifth Avenue or somewhere, it wouldn't matter. He will still be elected. I'm paraphrasing, of course. We heard an all-out assault, rightly so, on his misogynistic behavior and self-proclaimed grabbing of women in certain kind of ways. We heard all other kind of discussions. We mentioned a moment ago the women protests that sought to expose some of these contradictions, and we said something about its impact in 2020. We saw, despite the fact that Trump lost, we saw that he had a tremendous amount of support in many red states that would defy any candidate being exposed to those types of behaviors. So I don't know why we should expect anything different in the state of Georgia. There's an electorate here in the state and in other red states. So I think Georgia may not necessarily be defined as a red state, but nonetheless, other states who will vote for the Republican candidate, who will vote for the Democratic candidate. And they'll do so regardless of these behavioral aspects or other imperfections that we see among the candidates. But I think that there's something else to consider, though, especially in light of the conversation about Oliver, the Oliver possibility of throwing this into a runoff. And I think that's highly likely. I'm wondering now, I don't know if I have enough to make this point solidly, but depending on what happens in this this first head-up debate between Warnock and Walker, I think that may expose some problems. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that I think Warnock will outperform Walker in that. I could be wrong, but that's my belief, that he'll outperform Walker in that debate. But then what will occur is that it will have to depend upon, success will have to depend upon turnout for the runoff elections, right? Which is always a problem going forward in these elections. So I just want to make those points, Bill.
No, thank you. Patricia, jump back in.
Yeah, I think if tribalism were playing the only role here, Herschel Walker would be winning. He would be up with Brian Kemp and up over 50% if it was Republicans just voting for Republicans. There are some Republicans right now who are not comfortable with Herschel Walker, and they cannot get there with Herschel Walker yet. And there are an important number of Brian Kemp voters who are voting for Raphael Warnock right now in our polling. And so I think as we get closer, and especially if it goes to runoff, and especially if we have a replay of Senate control coming down to this race in Georgia, that's when tribalism will just blow everything else out of the water. We'll know who is in control of the House. We'll know that it's President Biden in the White House. And whoever wins that Senate race will determine the future of the Biden agenda, and also how it will set up for Donald Trump going forward if he wanted to come in and run for president. But right now there are, I think, a few other issues scrambling this race a little bit. Otherwise, Walker would be running as well as Governor Kemp is.
Oh, that's a, thank you. That's a really interesting point. Edward?
If I can sort of go back to the point Kurt was raising a moment ago about the debate, because I think that actually the debate may offer some more danger to Warnock than some folks perceive, because the Democrats have so far worked very hard to demonize Herschel Walker through the various ads and other activities, to the point that if Walker walks out there and comes across as a nice guy, as somebody that you could be comfortable with, as comes across as someone who does understand certain basic issues, his expectations, quite frankly, are so low right now going into the debate, given how effectively, I would say, the Democrats have run a campaign to demonize him. I think he can't help but win. It's not a matter of scoring points, who does pointedly better in a debate than everyone else. But the expectation level is going to be so high for Warnock, and the expectation level for many people is going to be so low for Walker, that I think Walker will probably end up enhancing his position simply by coming out there and looking like a nice guy that you could be comfortable with. But we'll have to see about that. But also, the bottom line, whether you call it tribalism or anything else, the fact of the matter is, in a 51-49 Senate, the Senate balance does rest here in Georgia in many respects on this race. And so I think a lot of folks are likely to come home to their respective base and vote on who they want to be controlling the U.S. Senate over the next 2 years.
Sonia?
Yeah, one quick point just to underscore something that Ed just said. I think it was just last week, Herschel Walker came out and said, I'm just not that smart. And Raphael Warnock, he's going to embarrass me and just try to make me look stupid and dumb in the debate. So when we talk about his campaign team changing and the sophistication of his campaign increasing, I think that's an example of that, right? Because he really has lowered the expectation right there based on that statement alone. And so it may mean then that a Raphael Warnock has to approach this debate in a slightly different way than he might otherwise, because it's true. The who won and who didn't win, it's now the factors and the grading on that has changed just because of the expectation level that Herschel Walker is now set.
Yeah, I think, Patricia, Democrats, the Walker campaign may have overplayed their hand just a little bit in this ongoing drumbeat of challenging Herschel Walker to debate. Why is he afraid to debate? Now he is. Be careful what you wish for. As Edward Lindsay points out, there are some ways in which the expectations are so low. We've seen Herschel Walker with this ability to feel like just an ordinary fella who, you know, he's just trying to bring country values to the way he approaches. I mean, there are things about that that are very appealing that Edward points out might be a winning approach to a debate.
Yeah, Herschel Walker, especially in a smaller setting, is just extremely charming. Very few people watch Herschel Walker at an in-person event and leave saying, wow, I can't stand that guy. You know, that's just not really the effect that he has on people. He's a celebrity, he's very well-liked, and he has a very humble demeanor and says frequently, I don't know all the answers. I'm going to ask a question. It's going to sound really stupid, but I hope that you'll just bear with me. However, I think when he gets too comfortable, he goes way off down a tangent that is hideously dangerous. This is why his consultants were wary of him debating in the beginning. And as much as Raphael Warnock was saying, you know, come on, don't be afraid to debate me, Herschel Walker was saying, name the place, name the time, and his quote was, and we'll get it on. You know, so it was getting between these two men like some sort of like WWE cage match. I think they're obviously trying to lower expectations, but listen, there is an expectation below which Herschel Walker can certainly fall in a public setting, a live debate. Yeah. He's never done a debate. He never did debate his GOP contenders. And so I think the risks, despite the low expectations, the risks for Walker are very real.
Kurt, I got to get to a break. So just a quick comment, please.
Well, just really quickly. I think I'm hearing something different in the circles that I'm in about Walker. I don't know that I'm hearing this notion that he, you know, his expectations are low, which they are, but that he can still win. I think there's a serious concern about how he will communicate very, very serious issues. And I think one important item to look at is the Warnock campaign's insistence. And I don't remember the most recent state of this discussion, but the Warnock campaign's insistence that he not receive, Walker not receive, questions prior to the discussion and what have you. And so part of that is to determine, to make sure that he performs a certain kind of way.
All right, I got to get to our final break of the show. We'll be back with more in just a minute.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Just for a moment, I want to make one more observation about this talk about the possibility of a Walker-Warnock runoff. Edward Lindsay, you pointed out the history of runoff elections in Georgia, just mentioned a number of the years when we had them. My example of just how high the stakes are, how treacherous runoffs can be, is going all the way back to 1992, Edward, when Paul Coverdale got himself into the Republican, was in a runoff with incumbent Senator Weich Fowler. That year, Bill Clinton had won Georgia on the way to winning the White House, and the president-elect came to Macon, staged a rally for Weich Fowler, got a big turnout, and yet, Edward, Paul Coverdale ended up winning that election. Not even the president-elect of the United States, who won Georgia, could put Fowler over the top. That's how treacherous runoffs can be.
Exactly.
Okay. Let's move on. Patricia, Your colleague, Mark Nisi, is going to be on with us tomorrow. And one of the things we're going to do is talk a bit, as he's been covering Coffee County pretty closely, and we'll talk about it in much greater depth on the show tomorrow. But there's been a development that's an important one to talk about today, and that's the Secretary of State's office has now said they are going to have all new election machinery sent down to Coffee County. The data breach down there, they say, did not jeopardize the system in any way, that the election machines are still secure, but if for no other reason than to avoid the appearance that there could be problems, they're moving forward with that. The point of all this is to say Coffee County has become a huge and important story as part of this ongoing narrative that the Trump allies have continued to put forward, that the 2020 election was stolen.
Yes, and Trump supporters went down to Coffee County and did infiltrate those systems, just as Trump supporters accused Democrats of doing, which is not at all what happened. But I think that they have to replace those machines just to convince people that there is no residual damage to those machines. If anything ever happened down there in the future, people could just point straight back to this and say, well, why in the world wouldn't you have just replaced those machines? But I'm sure Ed Lindsay has some kind of a unique perspective on this as a member of the State Elections Board.
That's Edward Lindsay. That's right. Wanted to bring you in because you were appointed earlier this year to be a member of the State Election Board. Give us your take on all this.
Well, two things. Number one, Patricia's absolutely right. The perception issue, I think, was something that the Secretary of State's office had to deal with here, because it's not only important that we have an accurate election, but that the people of Georgia have confidence in the election and whatever it takes. Let me also say that for our listeners, the State Election Board is holding a hearing on Wednesday, as a matter of fact, to go over the security matters and sort of outline what is being done to make sure that our elections are secure and accurate. And so I would ask folks to please tune in on that. We are certainly hopeful that folks will come away with a greater confidence in the outcome, because what we really want folks to do is we want folks to show up and vote and have confidence in the outcome, particularly if your side loses. I mean, that's a cornerstone of democracy, is that the side that comes in second has confidence in the outcome, and that's what we're going to be working toward. Regarding Coffee County, there's an ongoing criminal investigation that was launched at the request of the State Election Board, because we take this matter very seriously. And as a matter of fact, I actually even got deposed on this issue by one of these multiple lawsuits about 2 weeks ago. And someone said, well, how are we going to keep this sort of thing from Coffee County happening again? And my response is, well, a few people wearing orange jumpsuits picking up trash on the side of the road can go a long way toward deterrence. And I'm certainly hopeful that we will have some pretty strong responses to what has taken place. But anyway, the bottom line is that we are working hard, and it's a bipartisan board, to have folks have confidence in the outcome. What the Secretary of State's office has done is a good step. There's all the things that need to be done as well. But stay tuned in terms of what we talk about on Wednesday on the State Election Board.
Sonia, I'd like to. I hope Edward Lindsay is right, that the state board somehow can create an atmosphere in this state where people have trust and faith in the outcome of an election. But unfortunately, I think that's a very high bar these days.
It is, but I think that it's something, though, that everybody actually wants us to have. And I think that you see that also when in the AJC poll, we talked about the abortion issue and where it fell in that poll. But threats to democracy actually was quite high on that poll as well, after, of course, jobs and inflation and that kind of stuff. But threats to democracy is something that I think across the board, Georgians are really, concerned about. And the integrity of our elections absolutely is something that, the State Election Board and the Secretary of State need to and are taking seriously. And so that's a really good, strong right step in the direction of at least giving us more confidence that the people who are charged with overseeing our elections are doing so in a very objective way and manner towards the good for our state.
Patricia, I don't remember the way in which that question was asked specifically. But in a lot of the polls that we're seeing, threats to democracy has risen high up as an issue people care about. The problem in some of the polls is that Republicans and Democrats have a very different idea about what is threatening our democracy. And I'm not quite sure how the, I don't recall how the AJC addressed that.
Yes, we asked specifically, what do you see as the greatest, the most important issue facing the country, is how it was worded. And threats to democracy was one of those. And it, Senator Halperin's point, pulled way above abortion, actually. Abortion was at 5%, and threats to democracy was at 19%. And that was just behind jobs in the economy, which was in the 20s. But you're exactly right. Democrats and Republicans have different opinions of that, although it's sort of like two sides of the same coin. Same thing with election security. Who's trying to steal the election? Well, it's a very different story once you look under the hood. It was mostly Democrats pointing to that. It's also being asked in the same context of Fannie Willis's ongoing investigation into Donald Trump for election interference in 2020.
I am completely out of time for today's show. I'd really love to have more of an opportunity to listen to this panel talk about the issues today, but I sure appreciate the conversation. Kurt Young, Edward Lindsay, Senator Sonia Halperin, Patricia Murphy, thank you so much for getting the week off to such a good start today. A quick reminder before we leave you, Wednesdays is the day that we put out our Political Rewind newsletter. If you're not a subscriber, it's easy to become one. Just go to gpb.org/newsletters, and we'll send it to your inbox every Wednesday afternoon. That's it for us for today. We're out of time, but we are back with a brand new show tomorrow. Again, my thanks to the panel and to all of you out there listening to the show. I'm Bill Nygut. Take care, and please stay healthy. Bye, everybody.